Hello again, friends. And you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, the Mothership, the best wrestling podcast on the planet, the only wrestling podcast that matters. I am your host, the great Brian Last.
It's me!
And I am sick this week.
Yeah!
So the show's going to be a little different. A little different than you're used to. No top 10 this week. It'll come back next week. I'm going to hold it over just because I don't have a lot of energy. My voice is going. My throat hurts. My nose is stuffed and runny at the same time. I didn't know that could really happen. But for this different version of 605, a shorter version, I think. I usually say that and then the show runs the usual length. But for a shorter version of 605 this week, I have with me a man who is also sick this week. And he's sick maybe in the head usually, but this week he is also feeling under the weather, and that is my good friend, Tom Robinson. Tom, how are you today?
My man, I'm surprised you got through the intro without sounding as hoarse as you did earlier. We are two flu-ridden idiots. Well, I speak for myself on that end, but I'm getting over it and you're getting it, huh?
You know, you've heard stories in the past about, you know, the Undertaker got mad when he was working a program and Bob Orton bladed and he had hepatitis and it could have gotten him sick. I've never heard another wrestler say, "God damn it, you gave me the flu." Never heard that.
Yeah, that's true. They worked through the flu. Well, there was the, I don't want to be too current, but when Punk left, he said that they're Z-packing out the ass. I don't know if the listeners or you know that Zithromax, a popular antibiotic, but
of course, yeah.
Yeah, I wish I could have some of that shit now. I'll go to like a high drug area if somebody's selling a Z-pack.
I've never seen a street corner where they're selling Z-packs.
Exactly. You mean Z-bar? You want Xanax? No, fuck that. I want antibiotics, dude.
Well, we are both sick. This will be a different episode. A few in-house notes while I can still talk. Originally for this week, I had planned part two with the Grappler, and also, and many of you heard this on the Jim Cornette Experience this week where I announced it because I wasn't sure the direction of the show yet. I have a conversation with William Harding, which I think people are going to really go crazy for. He is the guy who got out of Bob Roop's sugar hold, costing the Poffos $1,000. It's an amazing story. So that's going to be pushed back to next week. Marty Goldstein, I also talked with, an amazing story about the Athletic Commission screwing with him and then them sicking Bulldog Bob Brown on him. That's going to be pushed back as well, just because of I wanted to talk about Chavo this week, because Chavo Guerrero just passed away. And I wanted to make sure something was done to talk about him, because I think a lot of people, it's easy to forget just how big a star he was for a while, especially in Los Angeles. So on that topic, this week on the show, I'm going to have Dr. Tom Pritchard, who was booked by Chavo in Los Angeles, but also got to see him growing up in Houston. So we're going to hear about that. And then Jeff Walton. I'm really excited about this because the conversation turns from talking about just Chavo to the entire ecosystem of Los Angeles wrestling. Jeff was the publicist for the LaBelle's wrestling organization. He did television announcing. He worked at every end of that business there. So it's a really amazing and fascinating interview. And Jeff's going to be back on the show soon, I think, because he was so good this week. The Grappler part two pushed back. And then after that will be part three. Just so everyone who's, for everyone who's wondering, part three will be all about Oregon. And that'll be in a few weeks, but part two will be next week on the show. William Harding next week on the show, and Marty Goldstein will be on within the next few weeks. And I got a few other things, and my schedule is a little crazy right now because I am sick. So that's it. That's all I got to say, Tom. Talk for a second so I can clear my throat.
I was just, I didn't know who the first, it was Harding.
Yeah.
I didn't know who that was until you explained a little bit, but that I'm looking forward to that myself as a 605er Mark. I always heard that story, and you talked to the actual dude, huh?
I talked to the actual dude. We're also going to have audio from Bob Roop talking about the actual occurrence, courtesy of Scott Teal and Crowbar Press. So I think everyone will really get a kick out of that. It should be pretty cool next week here on the show. But I want to mention that since the last episode aired, the debut of Austin Idol Live, it is now available everywhere you get your podcast, just about. Stitcher. Fuck you, Stitcher. I've had problems with them in the past. Apparently this week, the Jim Cornette Experience, which I don't even distribute, had a problem. It didn't go up there on time. So Stitcher can just drop dead as far as I'm concerned, but it's everywhere else. So please
fuck
check
Stitcher.
It out. Yeah, fuck Stitcher. But of course, you can go to Facebook too if you want to join the Austin Idol Facebook community, which we just started. Facebook.com/AustinIdolLive. And the shows are available at AustinIdolPod.com. We got a lot of really cool things coming up. If you're a fan of this show, I think you'll really like it. If you're a fan of Memphis wrestling, you'll really like it. And we're going to have a lot of audio that we're going to play on the show of classic Austin Idol interviews and have him react to it and tell us what's going on behind the scenes. We're also going to have a true or false Austin Idol segment where he has to say whether a rumor or a story others have said about him is true or not. And we're going to have special guests. By week 4, you'll have our first special guest. So check it out. Subscribe and download. I think everyone will really like it. It's a part of the Super Podcast family produced by my company, Arcadian Vanguard. So I hope everyone gives it a chance and checks it out, Tom.
I do as well. I'm like, you know, I'm trying to have like this persona now that you kind of gave me a platform, but I'm still just, I hate to use the word in case Bobby Fulton's listening. I'm sorry, Bobby, but I'm just an Austin Idol mark. And
no, but I think that's okay. His problem would have been if you used the word mark in a different fashion. You're saying I'm a mark.
True, true.
And his whole point was, I'm a mark. We're all marks. I'm going to get out of the car and walk. But, you know, you don't have to do that right now. Yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't see that little fucker recently. I shouldn't call him little. He'll probably be even more mad at me. But yeah, when we were playing around, revisiting the story, a look in his eyes was still like, man, this dude could probably kick my ass still. But yeah, just to go back to Austin, it was just for the public to know, you know, because I talk to a lot of 605ers, which I'm grateful for most. But anyway, I love all you guys. But inboxes and so forth, I kind of think I'm thought of as a liaison to you, but TGBL didn't tell me shit about Austin Idol. He told me in an off-air conversation, yeah, I've actually been talking to him a little bit, and I was like, that dude's the best. And little did I know he was putting together a show. But awesome, man. He's part of the family, and he to me, one of the most interesting people ever.
He's a part of the family. He was on the show last week. He'll be on the show again soon. And, you know, that was the thing. I just didn't want the surprise to get out. I kind of wanted everyone to be surprised when I made the announcement. I didn't want anyone to know. And every now and then I'm going to have these little surprises where no one knows what's coming up. And you really have to listen to the show to hear things that may or may not be there. So that's just my philosophy on things.
You're pulling a Pedro Morales, man. This gum not for the boys.
This gum not for the boys. People wonder what we're talking about. That's one of the classic stories on Austin Idol's show this week. This gum not for the boys.
I might have fucked up the punchline, but hopefully they'll listen and it'll make it that much sweeter.
Well, a few things.
Did I make excuses for sucking this week because I'm not feeling well yet?
Hey, I don't feel good either, so we don't have to make any excuses. The people understand what's going on. It's a different kind of show this week. It's a more rambling, incoherent, DayQuil-driven show.
Yeah.
The only other time was when Stuttering Tommy Rich had the NyQuil. That's the only other time someone took cough medicine on the air.
Drug-induced.
Yeah. So, and if anyone on the street corner has a Z-Pack, just let us know, and we'll be right over there. Yeah. Few things, Tom. You know, the Handsome Boogeyman's been very popular here on the show, and he'll be back, of course, next week with the championship match and the top 10. I recently converted a bunch of old VHS tapes to digital, and I'm trying to slowly upload them or quickly upload them online. Mm. And one of the tapes I converted is the Jerry Lawler show from the debut episode September 4th, 1983, up until November 13th, 1983. And I have a bunch more tapes of the Jerry Lawler show, so eventually I may try to get them all out there. But I'm trying to load these up one by one and also break apart any individual clips I think people would like. And there's a couple of amazing Jimmy Valiant moments that I want to play, because we joke about the Handsome Boogeyman, and there may be some people who never watched that much Jimmy Valiant who are saying, oh, he couldn't have been as crazy as Scott makes him out to be. But he was, and that's what we're going to hear about. So right now, let's go to a couple clips. This first one is Jerry Lawler introducing Handsome Jimmy and asking him a question. So check this out right now.
Now, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take this opportunity to find out what's been going on with some of the wrestlers who you've seen here in the past but aren't wrestling here now or haven't wrestled here recently. One of the guys who we're always interested in is Handsome Jimmy Valiant. Now, Handsome Jimmy, we want to know where you've been wrestling the past few months, what you've been doing, a little bit about your activities. So, Handsome Jimmy, just, you know, where are you and what are you doing, man? Tell us now.
You know, that's a difficult question, Kingfish. I don't know. I've been myself, brother. You know, a brother asked me on the street the other day. He says, where you at, man? I says, I don't know. Where you at? He says, I don't know. I ain't nowhere too. Yeah. You know something? That another asked me a question. He says, what do you think about the world situation? I says, why don't you ask Johnny Cash? Dear, 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 dick-a-doo, dick-a-doo. Well, I see I'm wearing black. Dick-a-doo, dick-a-doo, dick-a-doo. Yeah, I wear black because of the world situation. Yeah. Another guy asked me a question. One time, he says, hey, handsome Jim, man. I says, yeah, brother. He says, what kind of food do you eat? I says, well, yeah, I don't know, but I think if Nixon had to do it all over, he'd probably do the same thing, that Watergate thing, you know? Yeah, I'll tell you what kind of food I eat, Kingfish. I eat anything I want to eat. I'm all going on a diet. You know, I went on a diet, two kind of diets. Two diets, brother. One diet was enough to eat, you understand? A diet. I'll tell you about a diet, brother. You know something? The best diet is low carbohydrate and high protein. You know, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know where I've been. All I know, Kingfish, I love you, Jack. I love you to death, baby. You know something, people? I love Memphis, Tennessee. I love King Lala. I love Jared. Jared, woo, Messiah. I'm in love. I wish I could kiss something right now. I wish somebody was here to kiss that. Kingfish, give me a kiss.
Well, I hope you got more of that interview than I did.
Well, there's number one, Tom, what'd you think of that?
I was, I didn't know if I was allowed to laugh during, so I was putting my mouth away. That was hysterical. I never saw Jimmy as animated. You put that on the Facebook page, right?
It's on the Facebook page. It's also on the YouTube page under the account Arcadian Vanguard. And there's also the second clip, so I'll get your reaction at the end. We'll discuss all of this. Here's handsome Jimmy talking about how he wants a television show.
Well, we're back on the Jerry Lawler show, and, you know, ever since I got my own show, I've noticed a little bit of jealousy from some of the other wrestlers. I think there's quite a few of them that think that they should have their own show. So what I've done, I've gone out and given some of them an opportunity to see what it would be like. And one of them that we're going to see today is what it would be like if handsome Jimmy Valiant had his own TV show.
You know, Kingfish Lawler's got his own show. You know, handsome Jimmy wouldn't mind his own show. You know, I'm right out here at Overton Square, and the very first person, you know, I'm going to practice a little bit. The very first person that walked by here, I'm going to talk to. Well, here comes someone right now. How you do, sir? Well, Dave Brown. David Brown, you have a lovely daughter. How you doing, brother? How's the weather? Chilly today and hot tamale. I understand that, brother. Ask me a question. Any question you want to ask me? Give me a kiss. All right. Well, feel good. Give me my show. Kingfish Lawler, I want my show. My show.
I think Handsome Jimmy better stick to wrestling.
Well, there you go. There's two clips of Handsome Jimmy Valiant. Maybe high. Memphis TV.
It's exactly where I was going. That's a cocaine interview. Oh, my Lord. And I think Scott, does Scott have a cocktail or two once in a while?
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to, I didn't think he quote unquote partied like that from, I've known of him and sort of knew Scott before the show a little bit. But to channel that energy naturally is amazing. I got to give a little more props to Scott for capturing the singing and the just rambling and Jesus Christ. I remember, you know, Crockett vividly with my screwed up memory, but that was crazier than his Crockett stuff.
Somebody asked me what I like to eat, and I said, I don't know, but I think Nixon would do it all the same if he had to do it again. The Watergate. Like, what? What are you talking about?
Exactly.
You have to watch the second one where it's him and Dave Brown, and Dave Brown just walks on. You've never seen Dave Brown like this. He's totally, like, amused, but trying to play along. And then Jimmy Valiant kisses him, and he runs away, you know? It's just – you have to watch it. That video is called Handsome Jimmy Valiant Wants a TV Show, and that's available on YouTube under the account Arcadian Vanguard, and there's lots of other stuff. As of recording time, I put the first four episodes of the Jerry Lawler Show. Also, a couple of videos that I had Kurt Brown and Bob Barnett, two friends of this show, on Japanese TV on a game show. You should definitely check that out. It's really cool. And also a tape that was very popular in my tape trading days when I used to have tape parties. When it was sent to me by Bob Barnett, it was entitled Balls Out. And it's a guy named Billy Red Cloud having his testicles pop out against Bulldog Bob Brown in a match. So you can search for either Balls Out or Billy Red Cloud has a wardrobe malfunction. And it will be available there. I also put up the entire episode of Memphis Wrestling with Jerry Lawler versus Ric Flair. So lots of cool stuff on the page now.
I saw most of that. The last, I didn't, I saw the Flair-Lawler match before, but I shit my pants when I saw Barnett, Vandal, and Chris Zaviza, who, where is that guy now? Does anybody know?
No one knows. No one knows. He dropped off the face of the earth when it comes to wrestling.
I, as I've said too many times, my memory's the shits, but Zaviza came to my show when I, in 90, that Dennis put up for me. And, you know, he was a good guy. He was Mr. Japan. That's what we do. We were watching Japan tapes in the room after I came back. And, I didn't know he was over there. That was taped in Japan, right?
No, it was taped in California.
Oh. Still, it's mighty impressive. And Zaviza was a Michigan guy, I think, right?
Yeah, they flew him out to the West Coast to film it with Bob and Kurt. And I want to say that originally either Kurt or Bob weren't going to be on it and it was going to be Meltzer. And Meltzer backed out and gave one of their numbers. So Kurt, if you're listening, Bob may be listening, but Kurt listens. Let me know which one of you guys was originally not going to do it and was replaced, was the replacement for Dave Meltzer.
Was the Superfly Offy of Meltzer.
The Superfly Offy. The Superfly Offy video, one of the things I forgot to mention last week is when the fans start chanting, "We want Snuka" in the background quickly into the match.
Yeah, I got the page up now. That says it was 1986, was that?
That was beginning of 1986, so Snuka had been gone for a little more than half a year.
Huh, I thought it was before that, but yeah, I was mentioning that he looked a little jacked, and
no, he didn't.
Not Snuka jacked, but I got to pause now. When he slings the fire around, I think you'll be able to tell he was either he had a syringe or two in his day in the Isle of Fiji, or he trains with Lance Storm, one or the other.
I actually didn't think he looked jacked at all. I thought that was one of the problems, was he looked like a smaller version of Jimmy Snuka with no muscles.
Well, I mean, compared to the Snuka, that clip where he dove over the ropes, and so he was just really monstrous at that point. But take a glance again when you get a chance. I mean, you'll pull it up now, but when he's swinging the fire stick around,
I'll take a look.
He looks like a Snuka muscle head, or not. Paul Orndorff in his prime was fucking amazing. Kerry Von Erich, guys like that. He's not like that level, but looked like a little more than just the average protein shake every couple hours. Put it that way.
On the topic of 1986 WWF, Tom, the next time we do the Tom Robinson Impression Challenge.
Oh, no.
We're not going to do it today because me and you are both sick and we're going to cut this short pretty soon. But
yeah.
I want you to do the locker room of the WWF in 1986.
Yeah, I'll try. But, the ones that I pull off, like, that's great and everything. But I get emotional if I bomb on one. It's like
you've never bombed. You've never bombed, though.
No, there's a couple like that. Well, I'll say I can't do it, or I don't remember how he talks or whatever. But since you're giving me a heads up, I'll check out the roster. I'll look up the roster in 86 and try to do an ECW and showcase the ones I'm good at and cover my weaknesses on the other.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. But as I said, we are going to cut this short because although I had a rush of adrenaline with the show going, and I don't sound as sick as Tom could probably attest I sounded to just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, you sound like dog shit.
I feel like dog shit.
You're a pro, dude. You're a pro.
But so we're going to cut this a little short. We're going to now go to my audio with Dr. Tom Pritchard. Dr. Tom was on previously talking about Wild Bull Curry and growing up around Houston wrestling and a couple other points in his career we talked about as well. But this time we're going to focus on Chavo Guerrero, who Tom got to see in Houston. Tom got to work for and Tom got to work with. So it's a really interesting look at The Life of Chavo Guerrero, and let's go to that right now. Me and Dr. Tom Pritchard. I want to welcome back to the Super Podcast a popular former guest of the program, and that is none other than wrestling's preeminent doctor. You know, Dr. Jerry Graham's dead and Dr. Big Bill Miller's dead. That leaves us Dr. Tom Pritchard. Dr. Tom, how are you today?
Well, I might not be far behind, man, the way you're talking about the doctors here, but I'm doing great, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I'm not wishing any harm on you. Certainly not. But
I really
wanted you on the show today because Chavo Guerrero just passed away. And I know that Chavo and you, in many ways, your careers, you know, he obviously started well before you, but your careers interjected at various times. And I figured you'd be a really good guest to talk to about him here today. I guess let's start with El Paso. I know you grew up in El Paso, and that's where you first started watching wrestling. And, of course, that's where Chavo really got his break. And he was originally Gory Guerrero Jr., named after his father, the legendary Gory Guerrero. And then he became Chavo there. Did you actually see him when you were in El Paso?
I don't recall seeing Chavo actually wrestle in El Paso, but here's the interesting thing. When we moved to Houston, I believe it was around, yeah, it was 1969 because we got to watch the moonwalk. I wrote to the El Paso Wrestling office. They had an address on the posters. And I wrote to the El Paso Wrestling office about getting a subscription to their wrestling programs every week. And I didn't know if they even did that, but I got a nice letter back from Sal Guerrero Jr., AKA Chavo, telling me how much it would cost. And they sent me programs every week. Gosh, for a year, I guess it was, whatever, however long I subscribed. And I told Chavo that when I got to LA the first time in 1980, we had a nice laugh over that, you know, and Chavo had wrestled in Houston where I got to see him actually. He and Mondo, I don't believe Hector came by, but I saw them actually wrestle before I had my first match. And then when I went to Los Angeles in 1980, Chavo was booking and Mondo was there. Again, Hector was not there at the time I was, but he was always a really nice guy to me. He had his moments and had his temper, yeah, but he's always good to me. After Los Angeles, as a matter of fact, I went back to Texas, and at that time, Chavo and Manny Fernandez and Tiger Conway Jr. were working in the same the San Antonio area and Houston, of course, and they took me under their wing and called me their rookie. So, as a matter of fact, when Chavo left Texas that time, I took over his apartment. I just took over the lease and stayed in his apartment in San Antonio. So, yeah, I had a lot of the interaction with Chavo early on in my career, and then later on in my career as well, when I would see him and came back to Bill Watts' Mid-South territory. He and Hector were then working against the Rock and Roll Express and had a hell of a run. And I'll never forget Bill Watts coming back to the dressing room one time. I worked with Gina Hernandez, and I think it was Lafayette. And Gina pretty much ate me up, and Watts came back and says, "You can't let somebody just eat you up. Watch Chavo work. He works like a heavyweight. That's where you need to work. That's how you need to work." So, you know, Chavo was very influential on my career and a lot of people's career just by being around him. And let me ask you this. Have you ever had the opportunity to be around Chavo at all?
Unfortunately, I haven't.
Okay. Let me try and color this for you and describe it as best I can. You know how some people can wear a suit and they look like they're trying to wear the suit?
Yes.
And other people wear a suit and it just fits and it looks really good and natural. And that's how Chavo was. He was a professional. As much of a rebel as he was, he knew what his part was, and his part was the star. He was to be the star. And that's what I tell guys all the time, too. Don't dress with the part you have. Dress with the part you want. And that's how Chavo always approached this business. And he was a huge, huge star. A lot of people don't even realize that I believe he was on the card at Shea Stadium. You know, Chavo was in Madison Square Garden in the 70s. Working for the Junior Heavyweight Championship, and he was way ahead of his time doing moonsaults back then, landing on his feet, doing the high flying, and he never missed a beat. you know, he didn't, I can't remember exactly when this was, but obviously many years ago, we were talking, and he actually said, you know, humility wasn't his strong point either, but he says, hey, man, you know, I was pretty damn good. I said, no kidding, you were good, man. You were great. So I think it may, he might have realized he was pretty good at the time, but I think it was even later in his career when he realized he was ahead of his time, and he did a lot of things that nobody else was doing and nobody else could do at that time for that era.
I got to ask you, between writing the letters to the El Paso office and writing letters to the Houston office, when did your successful letter writing campaign come to an end? Because it seems like you always got things done and put yourself in a good position when you wrote a letter.
When I actually accomplished what I wanted, because I actually wrote a letter to Norm Kaiser and Jim Melby with the wrestling news and the wrestling review, and I wanted to get a press pass so I could go down to ringside to take pictures and just to get close to the action. They sent me a press pass, and then my brother Ken got me a meeting with Paul Bosch, you know, and it was just that relentless passion and dedication and never say die. And I think once I got in the business, I went completely crazy is when I lost my way. You know, I have a really good guy I've come to know, James Dixon, who's wanted to write this book. And we started writing the book of my life. But as I told him when we started, you know, we might get stopped here because there's some things I can't tell without telling this. And I can't tell this because then I got to tell that. And I don't want to talk about that. So there's no this without that. So we're kind of stuck here. And that's why, you know, a lot of things happen in life, happen to people. I never thought they'd happen to me, but they did. And the same thing happened with a lot of guys. So I can't point fingers, man. I should have been still writing letters and taking advice when it didn't. So,
well, going back to Chavo, when you get to Houston, when you first start seeing him in Houston, how did he stand out from the rest of the pack?
It's the same thing when you see someone who looks like a star. Gino Hernandez always wore a suit, and Gino always had that intangible buzz, that glow, that sparkle, that it factor. Chavo had the it factor. He was not a big guy, but he fought like a big guy. Shawn Michaels, same way. He was not a big man, but he fought like a big man. You didn't think about the fact that Chavo wasn't 6'1" or 6'4" or whatever when he came to the ring. He fought you like he was. He believed it. It was that fire that you cannot fake fire. You can't fake passion. You can't fake real. When you feel it, you feel it. And Chavo came from that West Texas believability, Terry Funk, his Gory Guerrero, Dory Funk Sr., Hanson, Murdoch, all those West Texas guys that when they went out there, yes, it may have been predetermined and a work, but man, they really had a great time believing what they were doing and doing what they were doing. And that's how Chavo was, no matter what it was. He didn't treat it as this is phony and we're going to go out and pretend and it's a performance. No, he was going out there and he was going to wrestle, and he knew his stuff, and he was very, very talented. He could tie you up if he wanted, and he was very entertaining. He captured people's imagination. He wore colorful outfits when he came to the ring. He was just that one of a kind in that era when there was very few one of the kinds.
We know he did it a few years later, but when you saw him in Houston, was he already doing things like the moonsault body press, as it would commonly be referred to now, but no one called it that then, that he was one of the first people to introduce in the United States?
Yeah, I believe he was, because that's what I'm saying. He was doing unique things that nobody else did. And back then, if one guy did it, then of course nobody else did it. Now, it wasn't like today where, you know, somebody sees a cool move and they steal it. Of course, it was, again, a different business, different era. But Chavo was also very creative and I think could change things up. But yeah, he was doing the moonsault. He was doing the backflips off the top rope, and he was doing the planchas and hurricanranas and everything the lucha style had. Of course, Texas had a huge Latino community, no doubt. And he was a favorite along with Mascaras and El Santo and Grand Marcus and Dos Tatas and all those guys. Man, but I think the premier and first family of Texas in Mexican wrestling had to be the Guerreros. You know, Gory Guerrero was El Santo's tag team partner. I mean, it was the legacy, the family ties, especially for me, because I came from El Paso. You know, I knew where Chavo came from. I knew the history. I knew that, you know, El Paso, West Texas wrestling was this crazy, far out, are they really mad at each other kind of stuff. And that's the attitude Chavo brought, man. You knew whenever he walked to the ring, he was going to fight you. It wasn't a play. It wasn't a play fight. It was a fight. And everybody believed it because Chavo believed it. And that's what he brought with him. He brought that with him every single time he went in the ring.
You went to Los Angeles in 1980, right around the time of the annual Battle Royal, and you said that Chavo was the booker. Was he the one who brought you in there? How did you get booked in Los Angeles?
Well, I was originally supposed to go to Portland, Oregon, and that was through Paul Bosch. And my last night, or my second last night, or whatever, I think it was my last night in Houston, Gary Hart told me I was going to Los Angeles. And I said, well, I thought I was supposed to go to Portland. He says, yeah, you go to Los Angeles first, then you go to Portland. So I just assumed Gary and Paul talked because I didn't talk to Paul after that. And I just stopped by in Los Angeles. It was okay with me to go to Los Angeles because of the world famous Olympic Auditorium. And, they called it the Madison Square Garden of the West Coast. So I thought, man, this would be cool because I'd seen all the pictures. And it was a cool building. And I met Chavo, and again, after I think the second week, I asked Chavo what the deal was. I thought I was supposed to go to Portland. He goes, no, man, you're staying here. I said, okay. Once again, I just thought they communicated, and I didn't communicate. So I wound up staying there a year, got a tour to Japan, worked with Fujinami, and that's how that worked, man. Chavo and Mondo both were very, very cool. I knew Hector, but not as well, so... I mean, it's just a very, very cool thing. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but for a kid 20 years old just starting out, you know, in Los Angeles, California, right down the road from Hollywood, and Van Nuys and whatever, you know, had my own apartment and was just enjoying life.
You know, you were a babyface when you got there. Chavo and Mondo were both babyfaces when you got there, and you were matched up against the likes of Bengali and Pistol Pete, and of course the dreaded Enforcer Luciano, and boy, that must have been a fun match to have against Enforcer Luciano. I hope he's not out there listening, but one of the worst wrestlers I've ever seen in my life. Sorry, Enforcer.
Well, yeah, you know who he was, right?
No, who was he?
He worked as Guillotine Gordon in El Paso. That's why it was so cool to just be around those. Ox Baker was there too. He and Ox were partners. The Los Angeles territory was anything but on fire. It was horrible. But it was great being a young guy. But as far as making money or doing anything, I mean, it was on its last legs. But Guillotine Gordon was this, just this crazy character in El Paso that I remember. Then when I saw him come in as Enforcer Luciano or whatever his name was back then, he had a patch over his eye and he was...
yes.
It was just insane, man. It really was insane, but I had a good time.
And the team of him and Ox Baker, you know, not the heavenly bodies. So we'll just put it that way. Not the heavenly bodies.
Thank God. Right.
But again, you know, you're working against guys like that and you're on the same side with Chavo and Mondo. Did you ever wish when you were there? I mean, obviously you said it before in the program, you always wanted to be a heel. That was something you really wanted to do. And eventually you got your opportunity several years later. But did you ever wish you would have had an opportunity at that point to get in the ring with Chavo?
Oh, by all means. Yeah. I mean, I did wrestle Mondo a bunch of times, babyface matches. But Chavo left, I think, I don't know how long it was when I got there because Chavo left and then Tom Ernesto came in and booked. So, but I have opportunities to tag with Chavo and tag with Mondo and again, just to be there and to listen to him and to watch him. And he could be very, very charming, very amusing, very funny. And like I said, too, he could be very passionate if you felt he was right and you were wrong.
And, you know, but that's what made Chavo Chavo. That's what made him who he was. He and Manny Fernandez could get in the damnedest fight and, you know, an hour later, be the best friends again. So, he's that guy. He really was that rebel, and he didn't mind telling you how he felt, whether you liked it or not.
Well, you know, the story has gone around. It's somewhat notorious that I think it was a Cauliflower Alley, where he confronted Vern Gagne, you know, 25 years after Super Clash 3 for screwing him on that payoff. And
right.
It created a big scene. Do you remember the first time you saw Chavo exhibit his temper?
I don't remember the first time. I just remember, and he's been hot on me a couple times, even though I thought we were playing, you know, I mean, I was just playing with him, and he said something really smart, and I thought, well, is he kidding or not? I looked at him and saw the fire in his eyes. He wasn't kidding, man. He was, and I thought, Chavo, I'm just working with you, and I'm playing. So, no, I don't remember the first time, but I just remember seeing it quite a lot, because he, I don't know, man. You know, as I get older, real quick, on a side note, Al Madrill was my partner in L.A., and Al was 30 years old at the time, so Chavo was 30 as well, you know, 10 years older than me. And I never understood why Al was so miserable. I never understood why he was just such a he just seemed miserable all the time and nasty to everybody, and I just didn't get it, you know. And then when I got to be 30, I said, oh, yeah, now I get it. So, because I was a young punk in the business, and, you know, I had some issues, and just like Al, you know, he had a lot of things that happened that I found out later on, and I said, oh, shit, same things happened to me. So, anyway, but, you know, I think that's what it was. Chavo was tremendous. Chavo was one of the greatest workers. Seriously, I'm not saying that. It's not just hype, but he really was one of the greatest workers in the business. And when it came time, you know, when Vince took over, he had worked for Vince Sr. quite a few times. And I think when Vince took over, you know, and I don't know if Chavo was got the call or was wanting to get the call or what, but sometimes, you know, I don't know if he felt slighted, but I just know that he knew he was good then. I mean, I think he should have been called to be good when it was time to be called, you know?
Yeah, that's very much in line with what Jeff Walton just told us here on the show. And
oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, almost verbatim, actually, that, you know, he ran into Chavo and Chavo, you know, had a drink or two and was telling him things were, I don't want to say unfair, but things should have turned out a little differently for him.
Right. And they might, and they probably should have, yeah.
And I'll ask you this, because of your post-wrestling career, although I think you still work every now and then, but, you know, in terms of being a full-time wrestler, after that, you got into the training. You are highly regarded for your ability to work with wrestling students and help young wrestlers or people just trying to fix things, hone in on their craft and fix things up. Jeff seemed to be of the opinion that if given that sort of opportunity, that would have been a role that Chavo would have done well in because of his passion.
I think he would have done very well in it. I think all the Guerreros have that ability. From what I've seen from Hector, Mondo, Chavo, and even Eddie, and Chavo Jr., I would venture to say, too, have it in their blood to pass down. And that's what I think once you stop wrestling. I mean, I think we all have that doubt at one time or another. Until we start the class and we realize we do know because we feel it, and this is it. The basics never go out of style. The fundamentals never go out of style, and they're necessary. They do it in pro football, pro baseball, pro hockey. They do it in any pro sport you want to look at. You have to revert back to your fundamentals and stay sharp. And I don't care how many have coronas or toupees you can do or drink a night. But if you can't lock up, you can't tell a story, all that stuff means absolutely nothing. And I believe Chavo, that was the main element in his work, is he knew where to put his stuff. He didn't just go out there and flip, flop, and fly. He went out, told a story with wrestling. When it was time, he put a flip in there. He put a moonsault in there. He put a backflip where he landed on his feet and hit you with a hurricanrana. It meant something. And yes, he would be a great teacher, a very good teacher.
You were in there in 85. You were finally given a chance to be a heel. And, of course, Chavo and Hector were there as the Alamo Busters. They actually took the spot of the Midnight Express as the lead heel tag team after the Midnight Express went to World Class, and they feuded with the Rock and Roll Express. From the best of your knowledge, you know, you talk about having a hot head or having a temper or really standing up for what you believe in. How did Chavo get along with Bill Watts?
You know what? I think he and Bill got along fine because Bill was the kind of guy probably like Glory Guerrero was as a promoter. But I will tell you this. Steve Kern told me a story, and I actually watched the match. He had to work with Chavo in Houston, and this was when Steve was staying with the Fabs, and I guess they came in, I don't know when, but to work with Chavo and Hector, and it was a loser-gets-painted-yellow match, and Watts came to Steve and says, hey, you know, I want you to take your time painting him, make sure he gets painted really good. Yeah, they wanted to rip Chavo, I guess, or Chiri. He might have been hot at Chavo. I don't know what it was, but you can tell Chavo was just pissed as he's coming to the ring carrying the can of paint. And this is in Houston. And I know the crowd, and I know the geography of the ring and the ringside people, as it were. And when the match ended and Steve starts painting, Chavo's hot, and Steve's trying to take his time and really get it on. And you can tell Chavo's getting a little bit hot, and finally had enough, and I think he dumps the paint off. I don't remember what the finish is. I just remember it's classic Chavo just getting upset, and that was a Watts finish. So I mean, I'm sure they got along. You know, there was I did hear this story too. Gosh, I don't think it was Chavo who told me, but anyway, I don't know, want to mention this fellow's name either, but he was learning how to book in the Watts territory. And he wanted Chavo and Hector to do something, and they said no. He says, okay, well, you're fired. And Chavo said, okay, hey, we'll leave. And so they went to leave, and they called Watts at the payphone, and they said, hey, man, we just want to let you know that, you know, Terry fired. Oh, sorry. His name has fired us, and we're going home. He goes, hey, he can't fire you. Go back in and just do the finish. There's the finish. You know what I mean? So that was just little things like that. And Chavo knew the game. He'd been around it. His dad had been around. His family had been around it for years. So he knew what was going on.
On the topic of Houston, I'm very curious as to what knowledge you have of what Paul Bosch on a Chavo. Because one of the interesting things is two matches that really stand out on that Paul Bosch retirement show in August of 1987 are you against Mark Lewin and Chavo versus Terry Funk. Because those are the two matches that really have nothing to do with the World Wrestling Federation, even though they have all of their talent on that show, and it really is the WWF with Paul Bosch doing that show. From the best of your knowledge, what did Paul Bosch think of Chavo? What did the Houston office think of Chavo? And also, what are your memories of that night?
Ooh, wow. How much time we got? Paul thought the world of Chavo Guerrero. He really did. He wouldn't have put him in the main event if he didn't. Chavo drew money for Paul, and Paul took care of him, no doubt. So I believe that's why. Same thing with me, man. It was like, because Paul gave me my start, and Bruce even told me, you know, I was a sentimental favorite to go on the card. Yeah, but that was a weird night because, you know, I hadn't... See, I had been training. I've known Mark Lewin since I was 16 years old and was going to the gym with him. And I know Mark, and Mark kind of introduced me to the devil's cabbage, if you will. And we would do this. So now here I am coming from Alabama, and I've got 85, 86. When is it, 87? When was it?
August of 1987.
87, so I'm 26, 27 years old, been in the business maybe 7 years, yeah, something like that. I'm in Alabama, and I've never been, my best friend in the business was Brad Armstrong, because we understood each other. We both understood. Brad was very an extrovert, but I'm an introvert. I don't get close to people. I never really got close to anybody in my life. And there's reasons that I wish I could find out. I searched my psyche all the time. But the point is, Mark and I worked out for years together. He was a star when I was just trying to break in. And you know, I never really asked him a lot, but we got there that night. And Mark had been a star in Houston for years. And they come and say, "We want you to go over to me." And I went, "Oh, Jesus, this is not good." And Mark's just sitting there. And then my dog's barking. Rene Goulet says, "Okay, don't use the rope or don't use the cables. Don't use the guardrail. Stay inside the ring." First thing he does, he shoots me outside the ring, straddles me on the guardrails. And sorry, I have dogs here going crazy, man. So anyway, and shows me with the microphone cable. So anyway, this is why I don't want dogs. I don't want any responsibility. Anyway, that was my life. That was my problem in life. Didn't want any responsibility. Anyway, that's what I remember about that night. It was, and there was a lot of other stuff going on, just personal crazy stuff. You can ask Pete Burkholz about that, because he can tell you better than I. I just heard it secondhand, you know. But Pete will have to tell you that story about the real behind the scenes of that night.
After that night, you know, your career would go on. You would work Alabama. You would work, of course, in Memphis. You would have what I consider a legendary run at Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I have to see a lot of those shows live, so you're still one of the best wrestlers I ever saw live.
Well, thank you very much. At least somebody's top list. But I mean, there's so many guys that were at that time, too. Man, you had your Benoit's and Eddie's going around, too. And anyway, at that time, it was just the whole thing was the whole business. Man, this culture has really changed. The business, the culture of the business has really changed for the better, no doubt. But I got to say, it really was a lot more fun back then, for us anyway.
Well, my question was, you know, you would go on to have this career. You would end up working for the World Wrestling Federation, first as a wrestler, then in various behind-the-scenes capacities. When did you next see Chavo? Did you ever keep in touch with him? Did you run into him here and there?
I ran into him, actually, at the WrestleMania party when he came to see Chavo Jr. work, man, and when he was Chavo Classic, when I go to some of the live shows, because... Gosh, we were on the road. But the last time I did see him was at the last WrestleMania party Chavo Jr. was at. I couldn't tell you when that was because it's been a while. And he was with his then girlfriend, and he was fine. As a matter of fact, I think Chavo had even probably told him, "Dad, you can come, but be nice," because I could tell he was making a concerted effort to be nice. And that was very good to see. So, but I mean, the problem is, and I'm coming to this realization. I came to the realization when Brad died about 4 years ago, that, you know, we don't keep in touch as much as we should. I just texted somebody last night just to tell him, "Hey, look, man, you've been on my mind. I just want to say hello." Cause I text Dusty Rhodes 3 weeks before he died. And he says, "Hey, man, I'll call you. I love you." And I told him the last time we actually talked, I said, you know, people are dying now, and I just want to make sure that I touch base. And he laughed. He said, "Yeah, people are dying, baby. That's all cool. I ain't never going to die." Well, a month later, he died. So, same thing with Chavo. You know, it's like, you don't think, I was busy Saturday. I didn't even find out until later that afternoon on the internet that he passed away. And that was one of those things where it was a jolt, because I didn't expect it. I had no idea. And that's what happens to a lot of us, is we don't keep in touch. And sometimes, like I said, Brad Armstrong was my best friend. He wasn't just an acquaintance. There were more acquaintances out there than were friends. And some of the guys that I train, you know, I consider... I consider closer than others, so I'll stay in contact with them too. But anyway, long story short, and didn't mean to veer off that alley there, but last time I saw Chavo was at the WrestleMania party that Chavo Jr. was at.
In closing, as someone who worked with Chavo, someone who worked for Chavo, and someone who got to see him as a fan, how do you think Chavo Guerrero should be remembered?
Ooh, one of the all-time classic and great wrestlers ever. In my opinion, Chavo rightfully should have been in that wave with the Pipers and the Hogans and the Orndorffs and those, because he had worked with Piper. See, that's there's the little issue. He worked for Senior. He worked for Vince Senior. He had these connections, Piper, all these people. He was not only good enough, he was great enough that he should have been there, and he should be remembered as one of the greatest of all time. He really, really should. Most for the people who have never seen him in his prime, you owe it to yourself to YouTube and search and look and see what he did, because he was way ahead of his time.
There it is, Dr. Tom Pritchard. He'll be on the show again soon. He's a great guest every time he's been on. But with this shorter version of the Super Podcast this week, we're not going to have a book of the week just because we're not. But I do want to tell everyone, Amazon, please, if you support this show, use the Amazon links, tinyurl.com/superpod. Amazon, you guys know how it works. By using that link, you support this show without spending any more money than you would normally spend at Amazon. But we get a little bit of love and a little bit of support from the people over there. So please, for any purchases you or any loved ones make, please use tinyurl.com/superpod, Amazon. And of course, if you want to check out a lot of free videos and get 2-day shipping for free on everything, you can do a free 30-day trial of Amazon Prime. That's tinyurl.com/superpodprime. No commitment. You can cancel before 30 days are up, but you get access to that video on demand library featuring lots of wrestling, including lots of Memphis. Apparently an entire year of Memphis is up on there, Tom, which is awesome. So please check that out for Prime, tinyurl.com/superpodprime. And to help out the show with all your purchases, tinyurl.com/superpod, Amazon. Lots of other shows have links they want you to use. Lots of other shows try to entice you to support their show. You have to ask yourself, which show gives you the best quality of content each and every week, even if the host is fucking sick? And I think you can come to only one conclusion. When it comes down to us versus them, fuck those guys. We've got a sick host and a sick co-host here on the Super Podcast.
Fuck those guys.
With that said, let's now go to the audio of my conversation with Jeff Walton. I think everyone will really love this. Jeff was involved in everything in Los Angeles wrestling. So we're not just going to talk about Chavo Guerrero. We're going to talk about the entire Los Angeles scene in the 1970s. Let's now go to this. I think everyone will like it. Jeff Walton. Joining the Super Podcast right now to talk a little bit about Chavo Guerrero and his run in Los Angeles is someone who is a former fan club president, a former publicist, on-air television interviewer, dastardly heel manager, fill in the blanks for anything I forgot, Jeff Walton. Jeff, welcome to the Super Podcast.
That's a great introduction. That really is. It's one of the better ones I've gotten.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Did I leave anything out? I mean, did I cover just about every area?
Well, I set up seats and arenas. I set up rings. I did pretty much everything there is to do in wrestling, including wrestle when I was in Tennessee as manager at Tux Newman.
That's right.
So I think I've done it all.
Well, as I said at the beginning, we're going to talk about Chavo, who just passed away. But before we get to him, to give the listeners a little bit of your background, talk a little bit about how you got involved with the Los Angeles promotion with the LaBelles, and also, I guess, your involvement with Freddie Blassie.
You know, I was very lucky. I really it goes way back to the early 60s. And you're right. I was Freddie Blassie's fan club president, along with my really good friend Terry Brote. And it's in the book that I wrote called Richmond 95171, which was the telephone number for the Olympic Auditorium to order tickets. And the book that I wrote kind of gives the whole overview of when I started, and I was always a big wrestling fan. And even when I was in the wrestling business, I was still a wrestling fan, because if you love wrestling, it doesn't matter what you do, you're still a big, solid fan. So
I managed, or I actually did Freddie Blassie's fan club for quite a few years. I got involved with the wrestling magazines at the time, Wrestling Review, Inside Wrestling, Ring Wrestling. I wrote articles. I took pictures at the matches out here. And then when I I was in the service, and when I got out of the service and went back to school and finished college all within a very short time, then I decided I still loved the wrestling business. And at the time, it was the golden age of wrestling. And we had guys like Freddie Blassie and Buddy Rogers, Bruno Sammartino, all the real greats. Those were the really golden years of the business. And I sent a letter to Mike LaBelle at the Olympic Auditorium, and I said, the program stinks. I said, I could do a better job with the program. And it just so happened that the guy that was doing the program at the Olympic was their publicist, and he was going back to his regular job, Jack Disney, at the LA Herald, because they had been on strike. And Mike said, why don't you come in and would you like to work here at the Olympic? But, you know, that's a dream when you get to do something that you love, and being able to do that 7 days a week, it became a real dream for a 20-something person like myself. And I learned the business from the inside out. And at the time, outsiders were really not privy to a lot of the things that were in the wrestling business. And wrestlers and promoters and matchmakers, they did not want outsiders in the business. It was strictly for them. They were the ones that were in charge. And it took me a long time to ingratiate myself within their circle. And once I did that, and I sat in on booking meetings and did a lot of the matches, gave ideas for matches, such as Roman gladiator death matches. And then I was accepted, and I loved it. And I went on to doing Mike's television show, which was on Channel 5, and then went to Channel 13 out here locally. And then we became very big on the Spanish International Network. I did the English for that, and then Miguel Alonso did the Spanish. So it evolved into quite a great career, and one that when I was out of it, I sorely missed.
It sounds like maybe your mailman has arrived.
Yeah, that's my dog. Anyway, And I got to meet practically every wrestler in the world at the time because they came in here. Unlike a lot of people said, well, this really wasn't a big territory, and you know, we didn't have a lot of great wrestlers. And that's totally wrong, because we developed all the great names in the wrestling business, from Buddy Rogers to Roddy Piper to you name it, Blassie, the top stars, you know, got their feet wet in this territory and went on to be major stars in other territories. So we were the biggest, if not the best, of all the territories at the time throughout the late 60s and 70s.
When you first got there, what were your impressions of the relationship between Mike and Jean LaBelle? And how often was their mother, Eileen Eaton, actually down at the Olympic?
Well, Mrs. Eaton came down when I first got there. She didn't come down. She was very ill. She had been in Hawaii. She got bit by some sort of a bug. Her weight blew up to a really hefty and dangerous state, and she wasn't in the office that much. But she was, once she came in, she was really an amazing woman, because she was the only woman boxing promoter. And she kind of stayed out of the wrestling business, per se. Her husband, Cal Eaton, had been the wrestling promoter here at the time. And then Mike took over after Cal Eaton passed away. Mike was the secretary treasurer for the Olympic Auditorium. Jean was the kind of brother that kind of stayed out of the business. He had been a wrestler. Of course, he's a master judo artist and a tremendous athlete. And Gene kind of gravitated to the stuntman Hollywood motion picture scene and did a lot of that, and then came in and did interviews at the time on television occasionally, and then, of course, on Channel 13. He was a regular after Dick Lane had retired. So their relationship was it was kind of strange in so much as Mrs. Eaton didn't go near wrestling per se. Mike got into it deeper and deeper as Mr. Moto and Jules Strongbow got out of the business, and Mike eventually took over Southern California. And by Southern California, you know, we went all over. We were in Long Beach, Costa Mesa, El Monte. We were up north as far as Fresno. And we kind of exchanged talent with Northern California, Roy Shire. And so this was a wonderful territory at the time with top stars. And, of course, we catered a lot as the years went by to the Hispanic population. And the Hispanic population grew and grew and grew. And we had to go with it. We had to bring in top Hispanic talent, such as, of course, Mil Mascaras. We brought in Ray Mendoza. We brought in Raul Mata. We brought in Ruben Juarez. And, of course, last but not least, we brought in the Guerreros.
And I guess on the topic of the Guerreros, who, you know, Chavo arrives in the summer of 75, and by that point, Louis Tellet is booking. What led to him getting the job as booker?
Well, I'll tell you something. I don't like to speak bad about anyone. I think that was the low point of Southern California wrestling with Louis Tellet. Louis Tellet was more concerned at that point in his career to kind of play golf and come in for 5 minutes and then leave. And then once he did come here, he not only made himself the matchmaker, he made himself the America's champion, the America's tag team champion with several wrestlers, and brought in a lot of good wrestlers. He brought back Carpentier. He brought back the Hollywood Blondes, wrestlers that he had worked with all over the country. But Louis, at that point, I don't think his heart was, he had a lot of personal problems. I don't think his heart was really deep in the business. And he really didn't show us what he could really do, I think. So that wasn't a long association. And in stepped Leo Garibaldi, who was a good friend of Louis, and he kind of threw everything on Leo Garibaldi. And I did not know Leo that well until that time, and then once I got to know Leo, I saw one of the finest bookers that was ever brought up in the wrestling business. Of course, Leo goes back with his father, Gino, to the late 40s, early 50s. And due to a back injury, Leo had to retire, and so he took over being the official matchmaker. And the bad thing about that situation was that Mike LaBelle and Leo did not see eye to eye as far as certain matches or wrestlers who should be put on top. But I remember when Leo brought in Roddy Piper, and he was 18 years old, 19 years old, and he was just going to, you know, come through here for 2 weeks and go up to Oregon. And we ended up keeping Roddy for 3 years. And Roddy at the time was young, but he was a tremendous talker. He was a tremendous bump taker. And Roddy just was, there was something very special about Roddy. And we brought him in as just a job guy and a baby face. And by the time we had him here for, a week and a half, Leo saw the potential in Piper and said, this is a heel. This is this guy will make a great heel. And at the time, Leo was down in San Diego, and he called me and he said, I'm going to switch Roddy to heel tonight. And I told Mike about this because, you know, I had to really kind of report to Mike. And Mike says, you go down to San Diego and tell Garibaldi I don't want Piper as a heel. We've got no future for him. So I went down there and I talked to Leo, and Leo sat down with me, and Leo said, Jeff, I'm going to make him a heel. I want you to watch him here tonight. It's not going to cause any major damage. You're going to see something that's incredible. So I sat there and I said, oh, my God, Leo, don't do this. Please, I'm going to get hell. I got to go back to work tomorrow morning. So anyway, I sat there And I watched Roddy as subtly he changed, metamorphosis into a classic heel. And I went back the next day and I said, Mike, you're wrong. Leo's right. This kid's going to make us a lot of money. And Piper did make us a lot of money, as he made all over the country and, of course, all over the world, really.
He absolutely did. And, of course, I think when a lot of people think of mid to late 70s Los Angeles, they think about Roddy Piper against the Guerreros in one way or another. But to take a step back first to that summer of 75, do you remember when in the office you started hearing about Chavo? Do you remember when the decision was made to bring him in? And also, Mil Máscaras had already been there. Raul Mata was still there at that time. How did Chavo get over right away?
You know, the minute we decided that Chavo would be an asset for our business was because we had heard a lot of great things about him from the Texas promoters. And they said, he's got a really good future and he's a really strong wrestler. And he's not a big wrestler, but he's a great ring technician. And so when we brought him in as the first Willie Guerrero, you could see from the first match on that he knew exactly what he was doing at all times, and he was very dedicated to making his opponent look good as well as himself. There was really no ego or anything of that nature such as you had with some of the other Hispanic stars. And he just went in, he did his job, he did it properly, and he did it very well. He was able to talk on the mic, and he had that charisma, he had that spark that you need. You have to have the ring savvy, and you have to have the vocal savvy on the mic, and that's what gets you over. And he had that. You know, he was able to speak perfect English and, of course, perfect Spanish, and that's what you needed, whereas a lot of the Hispanic wrestlers would come in, and some of them, of course, could not speak English at the time or did not speak it well. And there was an all-around uniqueness about Chavo Guerrero. And, of course, he came from a family of wrestlers at the time that we could, of course, say, well, this is Gory Guerrero's son, you know. And that didn't hurt either because the fans remembered Gory Guerrero from years ago and either seeing him in Mexico or seeing him in the border towns of Texas. And so that's how Chavo got over, and that's really how I met him. I was very impressed with him. I always liked him. I thought, you know, he was a very educated young man. You know, he was a coach in some of the high schools. He wanted to really teach. That was his kind of background to where he wanted to teach. But as he got more and more involved with the L.A. wrestling scene, he just held his own and went to the top very quickly.
Of course, he comes in the summer of 75. Louis Tillet is booking. By the beginning of 76, Leo Garibaldi's booking. And this is right when Roddy Piper gets there in January. And by February, Roddy Piper has become a heel. And pretty quickly, he's programmed with Chavo. And eventually, this builds out into the feud. And within just a couple of months into 76, Gory is brought back for the first time since Chavo's been there. Do you remember when Gory reemerged back into the scene?
Well, I remember that Mondo, the brother, the younger brother, was brought in, and I believe even Hector came in before Gory came in. Gory was kind of the last one that came in, and Gory at that time, of course, was a lot older. We used Gory a few times to headline. We put him in six-man tags or eight-man tags. And so you had the whole Guerrero family at the time that wrestled there. You had Chavo, you had Mondo, who was a tremendous talent as well. And then you had Hector, who was the youngest of the wrestling brothers at that time, come in. And now you brought in Gory, the patriarch of the family. And it was a real fourfecta that we thought would make a lot of money, and of course it did. And then Gory decided, he came up one day to my office and he said, what do you think if I take over one of the small towns, which would be San Pedro, California? There's a movie theater there, and I'd like to try to promote it on my own. So I talked to Mike about it, and Mike said, yeah, if he's willing to do that, that's great. So Gorey was here for a while, and he promoted San Pedro with a partner, Carl Lauer. And they ran San Pedro probably for about a year. And then, of course, Gorey decided that, you know, as he was getting older, he just wanted to take it a lot easier. And he left and went back. But in the meantime, we still had Hector. We still had Mondo. And, of course, we had Chavo. And they were just a great combination in singles matches, in tag matches. You couldn't beat them. They were just really, really good. And, of course, they split up with other wrestlers as well and tagged. But it was like a tidal wave. You brought in Chavo. He was great. Drew a lot of big money with Roddy Piper. You brought in Mondo. Now you had Mondo and Chavo. And if you wanted to do something with Roddy Piper, Piper would take in a partner like Bull Ramos. And they would team up against them. There was money. It was gold, no matter what. Finally, Hector coming in. There was another tidal wave. It just renewed everything. And, of course, titles went back and forth. And they wrestled. Oh, they must have wrestled umpteen times at all the clubs. And, of course, headlined the Olympic in main events, 50 times maybe. And drew money.
Well, that's my next question, is how business was. As you said, the low point in your eyes was when Louis Tillet was booking. It was a relatively short term, just a few years earlier. You know, that's the interesting thing. You know, you have these two young guys in Roddy and Chavo, and it feels like a very young, fresh thing. But just a few years earlier than that was the legendary Tolis and Blassie program. So,
correct.
At this point in time, in 1976, going into 77 and 78, the 3 full years that Piper's there, and of course that he's programmed, for the most part, against Chavo and his family. You know, there are different times where they work against different people, but it's kind of a long-range, ongoing program. How was business?
Business was terrific. I all through the mid-70s, as they were here, business was terrific because, of course, you had the Guerreros on top, and you had Piper, and Piper with all his partners. We had Piper's Army, which he brought in new wrestlers, as I said before. It was hard to, after Blassie and Tolis, it was very hard to get back on track because we had drawn so much money and we had had so many Blassie-Tolis matches in all shapes and forms and sizes. So it was hard in that respect. But as I said earlier, this is a territory that made stars. They made stars. They brought in guys that worked underneath in other territories. And Bull Ramos, Black Gordman, the Great Goliath. These guys became stars here. They were known all over the country. And, of course, our Spanish International Network program was syndicated back east, and a lot of the fans were able to see it on television back there. And, of course, Vince McMahon, Senior, capitalized on that and brought in a lot of guys, including Piper, from Madison Square Garden shows. So we were really feeding the country with a lot of great stars that had made their bones in this territory.
That is one of those things that people on the East Coast and throughout the country, if you got the Spanish International Network, you got to see Chavo, you got to see Piper, you got to see everything that was going on there. When did the Los Angeles promotion first get on that network?
Well, we had really, after... They had pay-per-view television. They were starting pay-per-view television, and pay-per-view television didn't really go that well. And so along came the Spanish International Network, and we were featuring more and more Hispanic wrestlers, as you had said, Raul Mata, Rey Mendoza, Mil Máscaras, Brazos. We had all kinds of these stars coming in for the house shows. So... Mike decided that we should try to get on the Spanish International Network and feature these guys and also have, of course, a second wrestling show. We had wrestling on the English Channel on Saturday nights, and now we would, where we were off Channel 5, we had been on Channel 5 for years on Wednesday nights, we could then switch over to the Spanish International Network because it was just coming into being, and they were televising into all the Latin American countries. So Mike said, this is great exposure for us. Plus, he was getting paid for the TV show. So that went on for quite a while. And so we would do tapes, and those tapes would be shown all over with all the guys. And of course, it went into the East Coast. So we were kind of the forerunners of cable TV, so to speak, with our shows going into other territories. And not in a hostile way that we were going to go in there and run up to that point. If you had your show in another territory, you were going to go in there and you were going to invade the territory. So there was no threat of us doing that. We just, syndicators for SIN did that themselves because more and more the Spanish-speaking population was growing on the East Coast, and it was growing, of course, out here, and it was growing in Texas, and it was growing in Chicago. So why not? You know, I think a lot more could have been done with that, but it wasn't done. Mike was just interested in getting his product out and getting paid for it.
When you get on that network and you know it's airing in other territories and other markets, do you give a courtesy call to a Vince McMahon senior and say, hey, listen, we're going to be on television in your area. We just want you to know?
Yeah, we did do that. Because, again, another promoter would say, they're going to come in. They're going to invade again. If we went into Florida, right away, Eddie Graham would call, and Eddie Graham was the promoter in Florida at the time, and he'd say, hey, your show is coming in here on the Spanish. What are you guys doing? What are your plans? And, of course, Mike would tell them, well, we have no plans of coming in. Now, if Mike would have been as smart as Vince McMahon or Vince McMahon Jr., he would have maybe said, hey, you know, we're thinking of coming in there. You know, that was the later takeover by Vince Jr. And, of course, at that time, the stations would pay to have a wrestling show on the air. Vince Jr.'s changed all that. He would come in and he would offer $2,500 a week to get his tape played on your station. And, of course, the stations were thrilled to death to be able to get that kind of money.
Yeah.
And also have a product that they could show for an hour a week.
And just to give a little bit of background for the listeners, what was, by the time Chavo got there in 75, the situation in Los Angeles with television wrestling? When exactly and what caused Dick Lane to leave and also the loss of the KCOP studio wrestling show?
Well, we had one complaint from a person that said that our wrestling show for an hour was a complete commercial. Well, of course, you know, you want, that's wrestling. You want to promote your wrestling business. And in those days, you just didn't have a television show. You promoted your non-TV events, which out here were Friday nights, every Friday night or every other Friday night. And that was the main reason that you had a wrestling show. Well, this guy apparently called the FCC, and he said, these guys are just plugging away. It's just a commercial for a solid hour. It's not entertainment. And so the FCC decided, okay, well, we'll take a look at it. And they took a look at it, and they decided that, yeah, maybe this guy's right. It's one solid commercial. So they sent Mike, of course, a warning, and they said you cannot mention Friday nights unless you take a certain portion of your TV show and use that to plug your show. But during the show, you cannot do it. Well, you know, we were very careful for a long time because of this. Mike didn't want the FCC to come down on us. So we did this. And then we brought in Greg the Hammer Valentine, Johnny Valentine's son, who was a tremendous worker and a great talker. Well, Greg took it upon himself to just give one hell of a TV interview and a plug for wrestling that he's wrestling the world champion at the Olympic Auditorium this Friday night, and just kept talking and talking and talking. And sure enough, the FCC, or this guy that had reported us, taped it. And I guess the FCC fined Channel 13 about $25,000. So they were mad at us because we did that, and they took us off. They took us off very quickly. And now we didn't have an American television show, and we had one of the top shows running every week, every Saturday night, and we had to decide, well, what do we do? So none of the stations wanted to take our show, and we tried. And it also had a ripple effect across the United States after that, so that all the TV shows in the various territories were sent notices by the FCC that they had to be careful, and they had to designate just a little bit of time to plugging whatever wrestling that was non-televised on their program. Well, they got really mad at Mike, of course, for this thing, and that blew over, and finally we were able to get our show on the Spanish International Network, which was a UHF station, and they were showing novellas, soap operas. They didn't really have that great a programming, but our programming was, of course, live, and our programming was very popular because it coincided with the Lucha Libre style of wrestling. And then we brought in more wrestlers, and we decided, let's just focus on the SIN network at the time. And it paid off because we brought in the Hispanic population in Southern California. What we did lose was a lot of the American viewers, because a lot of the show was all in Spanish, except for my commercials, my plugs for the shows that were coming up on Friday. And I did those for quite a while. I would say I did those for maybe almost 2 years before they said, we don't want Jeff doing English anymore. We just want the Hispanic announcers to do it all in Spanish. So I stopped doing that. But of course, it still paid off because we were still drawing with our Hispanic wrestlers. And that played into, of course, Chavo, Mondo, Hector, Mil Máscaras. And business, to get to the final point of everything, business was tremendous at that time.
If I asked you to look back at the Chavo Guerrero Roddy Piper feud, what are some of the biggest moments or best memories you have of that run?
Well, I think the best memories I had, because I did the interviews with them, were the TV interviews. Piper, in those days, you didn't have scripts, you didn't have creative writers or whatever they have today. You just did it off the cuff. And these guys were very, very, very good. And Piper and Chavo had a love-hate relationship for each other, and they just did tremendous interviews. And I remember some of these interviews, and Piper, of course, would just be on the cusp of really some heavy stuff as far as Hispanics and what he was going to do to Chavo once he got him in the ring. And all of those matches that were main event matches, whether they were non-title, whether they were Texas death matches, whether they were title match, they all drew. And with Piper and Chavo on top, we kept going as much as we could with them on top. And it got to the point where I even said, God, these guys have wrestled. They can wrestle each other blindfolded in their sleep in a pitch black room, because they had worked so much together. But when they did work together, it was like magic. And that's the key of drawing money. And we had a good storyline that went on and on and on and on. And yet, you know, Piper could lose, it didn't hurt him. Chavo could lose, it didn't hurt him. And these guys were professional enough to where they didn't have egos, nothing got in the way. They went out there, they just thrilled the crowd. Piper was a tremendous bump man when he was young. He could take bumps like I've never seen in my life. And that, of course, attributed to his hips and everything else, because it's tough, you know, you're doing that night after night. And Chavo, on the other hand, was just fiery. You had that Hispanic fire within him that drove him to have a good match. And I don't think I ever saw Chavo in a bad match. And I don't think I ever saw Mondo Guerrero in a bad match. In fact, I remember Mondo wrestling rugged Ron Starr at the sports arena, and it was one of the best matches I've ever seen. And there was quite a bit of a weight difference and height difference, Mondo being a lot shorter, and of course Ron Starr being a brute of a guy, you know, like Bruiser Brody. And they had a tremendous hold-to-hold match that was just a thriller for about 35, 40 minutes. Hector was the high flyer. Hector did the stuff that you really see today. He just could do everything with the ropes, and it was a whole different ball game with Hector. And he had a likable personality, and the people liked him, and he went out into the crowd, and they hugged him, and it was just a magic thing. So now you had these three guys that drew. They drew. Hector and Mondo would be in tag team title matches. Chavo would be in a singles match against Bull Ramos or Black Gordman or whatever, and you had magic and money-making matches that were drawing. And of course, with Piper catching on, Piper was the first guy after Blassie to catch on. I remember this distinctly because we brought in Killer Kowalski, and we thought Killer Kowalski would set this place on fire. But what Killer Kowalski did, he worked so solidly and really to the point where people said, nobody can beat this guy. He's a big, you know, guy. And this was, of course, in his later days when he was just about ready to hang it up. And in the meantime, after Kowalski came Piper. And I, you know, we had no terrific heel like Blassie or Buddy Austin or anything of that nature. And I was really getting a little worried because I couldn't see anybody being mean enough or get the people angry enough to draw big money until Garibaldi switched Piper in San Diego, and then we just had gold with Piper.
And of course, it was a different dynamic at that time than it had been just a few years earlier, because as you laid out, you lost the English-speaking television. You're only on Spanish International Network, and the Guerreros are beloved. Chavo is the top guy. And then you have Piper, who's doing these, you know, incredibly hardcore, you know, I don't want to say anti-Mexican, but just very, very pushing the line.
Oh, interviews. That's what he did. Yeah. And that's what drew. He knew just the right buttons to push to get these people to say, I'm calling, I'm getting tickets. I want to see this guy destroyed. And, you know, whether we put a mask on Piper and called him the Masked Canadian or whatever we did with Piper, put a dog collar on him or whatever, he drew. And he knew that he would do well. But there was never any kind of a ego problem with him. It's not like you would go down and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, Piper. And Piper would say, no, I'm not doing that. But he did it. He did everything. And the same thing with Chavo. Chavo, I'd never had a problem anywhere with Chavo. Chavo would question it, and Chavo would say, you know what, maybe we could do this or we could do that. Now, the one thing with Chavo was that after Tele and Garibaldi left, Mike offered the matchmaking position or the booking position to Chavo. And before he did that, he sat me down and he said, Jeff, what do you think if we let Chavo be our booker? And I said, Mike, I said, this is a young guy who's still got a fantastic wrestling career. I don't think he's ready to be a booker. He's only been in the business not that long, and it takes a lot of insight to be a booker. I know, and Mike said, well, he wrestles. He ought to know. I said, yeah, but I said, I don't think he's ready. But Mike went ahead and gave Chavo the booking spot, the matchmaking spot. Not only did he do that, he brought Chavo in one day and brought me into the office, and he looked at me, and Mike said to me right to my face, he said, Jeff doesn't think you're going to be a good booker. And Chavo looked up at me, and I was really kind of nervous because I figured, oh, shit, this is it. I'm going to get it. And Chavo said, "What do you mean? Why are you saying that? I'm going to be a great booker." And I said, "Chavo, I'll be honest with you. I don't think you have enough experience to be a booker. Not only that, I think being a wrestler, which you still are, and being the booker, it's a conflict of interest. And I think you're going to be sorry. And I think it's going to bounce back on you." And I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, Brian, but 3 weeks later, Chavo comes into the office and says, "I can't book." And Mike said, "Why? What's wrong?" He says, "Because I'm having too much trouble with the boys. The boys are not going for my ideas." And he says, I'm still wrestling. I don't want to do it." And then I learned. I really felt good because I wasn't wrong. And Chavo never had hard feelings against me because he knew that you can't be a booker. You can't be and also wrestle at the same time as well.
And who did take over as a booker at that point?
Well, at that point, Mike took it over. Mike didn't really bring anybody else in. Mike and I, we were doing the booking. And it was from that point on that we came up with our matches for, you know, months ahead of time. And hopefully the guys wouldn't get hurt or, you know, wouldn't leave so that we could complete it. But we had a lot of problems, you know. Word got around that the L.A. area, the Southern California area, was not a good payoff area. And to a degree, it wasn't for what the boys, you know, how hard some of the boys worked. But it was a good area in so much as you didn't have to go thousands of miles a week in this territory. You could go to a club. It would only take less than an hour to get to maybe one of the farthest clubs and be home that night. And if you had a family, you know, be home with your family. It was a good territory to be in. It had always been like that. So a lot of wrestlers wanted to come here because they didn't have to work and drive all day and all night to the next spot. You know, when I was in Tennessee, I drove about 35 to 4,000 miles a week to go to various clubs and stuff. So this was a wonderful territory. Beside the weather, too, was always nice.
Well, things definitely did change after Piper left. It seemed that there never really was another dastardly heel, another really strong heel you could put on top against Chavo, who stayed around. Chavo was still working Los Angeles shows, until the end of 1981, at least.
Yeah, that's very true. Chavo made this his home base and lived out in Fountain Valley and wrestled here as much, you know, as possible. And he went back and forth. He went to Texas. He went to San Antonio and El Paso. And he did a few stints in Japan. Yes, you are right 100%. After that, we brought in a guy by the name of Rock Riddle, and we wanted to push Rock Riddle. He didn't want it. He wanted to get into the Hollywood acting field. We brought in Eddie Mansfield, who was very controversial after he left here because he decided that he wanted to expose the business. And Eddie Mansfield didn't draw for us either. So we were now focusing on the Hispanic heels and trying to get the guys like Gordman and Goliath, breathe new life into them. So everything changed. The dynamics of everything changed because we also had a new owner of the Olympic Auditorium. Eileen Eaton and Mike LaBelle didn't own the Olympic. They just rented it from the LA Athletic Club. They were paying about $1,500 a month for the use of the Olympic 7 days a week, and also got the parking lot concessions and got the rents from some of the other buildings that were on that lot at the time. So why did they buy the building? They were making good money. And the LA Athletic Club didn't care because they were getting rent from their property. But they offered Mike and Eileen the chance to buy the building and buy the property, and they refused. And what happened was a gentleman by the name of Needleman decided that he would buy the property because he owned parking lots all throughout downtown Los Angeles. So he bought the Olympic, and Mike and Mrs. Eaton, they didn't get along with him, and eventually Jack Nadelman kicked them out of the Olympic. And now we didn't have the Olympic. We had to go to the sports arena, which was a huge building, and it was a little ways down the road.
How much was the rent on that?
To open the doors on that at the time was about $10,000. So that was a lot more than $1,500 a month.
Yeah.
Mike wasn't too thrilled about that. Things started to decline. SIN wanted a 90-minute show instead of a 60-minute show. And the wrestlers here, to get good wrestlers here, it was very difficult. What Mike was doing was trying to bring in guys from the East Coast on their way back from Japan, such as Bob Backlund. Vince Sr. would tell Backlund, well, on your way back, you stop in L.A., you work the one L.A. show on a Friday night. So we got Andre the Giant periodically. We got Bob Backlund. We brought in a few of the guys from the East Coast that were, again, coming back from Japan. Some guys wanted to stop. Other guys didn't want to stop here and work. So there was a lot of changes going on. And the biggest change was that we cut down on the matches on SIN. We gave them, in a 90-minute show, we gave them two matches in a 90-minute show with, like, a tag team, Gordon and Goliath against somebody, or Chavo against Tom Pritchard if he was a heel or whatever. And that was it, you know. And, of course, the fans were complaining and everybody was complaining. Gene LaBelle and I went to Mike and we said, Mike, can't you get on a regular American channel and so that we could push our wrestling? It's been a number of years since the KCOP thing. And Mike says, no. Ever since KCOP, we can't get on any local channels. Nobody will take us. But what it was, of course, Vince has started this thing of paying the stations himself the $2,500. And Mike didn't want to do that. Because Vince, when I went to work for Vince and was starting out his magazine in around the mid-80s, Vince said to me, why don't you have American TV on there? And they, I said, because Mike said we can't get TV on the local channels here. So Vince said, okay, I'm coming in Saturday. This is Junior. He says, I'm coming in Saturday. You pick me up and you take me to Channel 9. So I picked him up on Saturday morning. We drove over to Channel 9. He was there for maybe an hour. And he comes out and he says, okay. He says, I got TV on Channel 9. We start January 1st. So at the time, he let Mike know, and Mike was going to be his front man for L.A., and they were going to run at the sports arena, and he started his TV show. That was the very first show that he got on in a territory. And then by March 1st, this was January 1st that the TV show got on. By March 1st, they had their house show at the sports arena with his TV. So that was kind of the end of everything.
Yeah, and that's like a little known fact that a lot of people forget when everyone thinks of the national expansion. They always go right to 1984, right to the raid on Vern Gagne, right to getting Hulk Hogan and Gene Okerlund and David Schultz and everything else that happened. This is 1983. Yeah. This is a year earlier. Vince goes into Los Angeles. So now he has New York and he has Los Angeles. He also gets USA Cable by the summer. So he's able to get into a lot of other different markets. He starts going head to head with Ole in some of those towns like in Ohio and Michigan. And that's it. That right there is the beginning of the national expansion.
Right. That was it. So this was really the beginning. This was, you know, before anything. And Vince had said he was going to do that. He, when I went back there to do his magazines, he invited me out to his home to have dinner. And we had dinner. And after dinner, he said, I'm going to change wrestling like you've never seen it. I'm going to go into these territories and I'm going to promote all these territories and we're going to go worldwide with this. So he had expansion plans from the very beginning. And he got very lucky as well. And, of course, now he's got this huge guy, I don't know the word for it, but this huge thing where he's the number one wrestling company in the world.
It's a monopoly without using the term monopoly is what
you,
it is.
You said that, not me. Right?
I did. I'm willing to speak to shareholders if they want to speak to me.
Yeah, right. But it's so true.
You know, going back to this, so this is the beginning of 1983. By that point, Michael Bell has pretty much shut down. He has just kind of resigned himself to where things are, and he's getting ready to move on. And Vince makes this deal. Vince makes this deal to not only get on English-speaking television for the first time in a decade in Los Angeles, give or take, but also he's going to use Michael Bell as his front man in Los Angeles. How long did that relationship and working scenario exist?
You know, that lasted maybe a year. And then word got back to Vince that Mike had told Vince that he owes him money. And Vince said, "What do you mean I owe you money?" And Mike said, "Well, I've been, of course, co-promoting with you on this thing here, and you owe me about $40,000, whatever it was." And Vince, of course, who came out here and got the deal with the TV station, didn't see it that way and figured, you know, this was just keeping Mike busy. And, of course, it was his front man. And that's not what was going to happen. I think that they had some sort of a lawsuit and Mike won a certain amount of money, but it wasn't much. It wasn't near what he was asking Vince for. And that caused a big rift between both of them. And that was the last time that Vince ever had anything to do with Mike. And that was when Mike got out of it. Mike was just so mad about the whole situation. He didn't even want to talk about wrestling or anything of that nature, and got into a kind of like a home business where he did videotapes of old movies and things like that. And that's how he spent a lot of his years creating and doing and having this little business. And Mike, of course, was wealthy from his mother, Eileen Eaton. That's kind of the whole story in a nutshell. Chavo, of course, went on to do other things and into other territories. In fact, when I had talked to him one time, he was booking with Blanchard on in Texas. And I called him once or twice to talk to him. And then about 3 years ago, I ran into him out at the LA airport at a wrestling convention. And I decided I would go. And he was there. And we sat down at the bar. And he had one or two drinks and talked about the business as it was then. And he was very bitter about it all because he figured that the business did owe him quite a bit. And you know, he came across as being, you know, bitter, and because the guys were making a lot bigger money than, you know, what we made here at the time. You know, we worked some nights on some shows for $25 a night out here. And of course, now they were signing contracts and doing all that stuff. And, you know, his reputation kind of got worse. He wouldn't show up for various dates. And it just kind of rubbed off the wrong way. And he had a lot of demons, you know, a lot of personal demons. So when I saw him at the airport, he said to me that he had made some big mistakes and it didn't work out for him. He had, of course, a divorce, and I think the drinking thing was a big issue as well as other kind of issues in his life. So he wasn't a happy guy. I have not talked to him, of course, recently, and I was really sorry to hear of his passing because this was a guy that could have had a phenomenal career afterwards teaching wrestling or working with Vince in the developmental process that they have in Florida now. I think he would have been a tremendous asset to them for this and teaching these young guys not only the in-ring technical work, but the how to speak and how to get themselves over, because a lot of these guys, they're not able to get over, and there's a lot of guys out there that work as managers that they should employ to get these guys over. But if they're taught from the very beginning how to get themselves over, both vocally and athletically, there's no stopping them. And I think he could have done that. So I think a lot of the potential he had was really wasted. I know that he went back and he worked as a coach and a teacher. And I think that's initially what he really wanted to do. But I think if he would have just had better guidance and got in with the wrestling situation that Vince now has, or that Triple H has set up, which is a tremendous idea, and that's the way to keep the business going, he would have done fantastic.
In closing, looking back, what is the legacy and what is Chavo Guerrero's place in Los Angeles wrestling history?
I believe it's a really historic legacy. I think that he is one of the standouts of Southern California wrestling, along with John Tolis and Freddie Blassie. If we had our own award or the history of wrestling here, where guys can be awarded awards, it would go to those three. Chavo was very creative in the ring, bringing his brothers out here, and of course his dad. I think it helped the territory immensely. And I think in his prime, I think there was nobody better than Chavo Guerrero to excite the crowd and to give 100% of his ring ability. That's the best he could do. And I really hope one day that if WWE has their Hall of Fame, and they would think kindly of adding him to the list, because he was a tremendous, tremendous talent.
There it is, my conversation with Jeff Walton, and you'll be hearing more about him in the coming weeks. I'm going to profile his book as one of the books of the week, or as the book of the week, I should say, on an upcoming episode. And what a great guest, what great insight and knowledge he has about wrestling, especially that period where Vince really first went into Los Angeles and was trying to do things. Great guest, and I got to thank Jeff for the time he gave me and the Super Podcast this week. But now we're going to wrap things up. Tom, usually it's your Twitter. Is that what you're going to plug?
Yeah, man. I just at TR Shock. I appreciate all the followers from 605. And, you know, you got me about, 500, 1,000 followers since I've been coming on this little show. So thank you, TGBL.
Well, I don't think I deserve all that credit. I think you deserve the credit yourself. But this is not going to become the Sammy Maudlin show with you and I giving each other pats on the back and forth. But a few show notes. You guys know you can follow us on Twitter at 605pod. You can follow me on Twitter at GreatBrianLast. The show is on Facebook at facebook.com/superpodcast. Big props to Travis Heckle, who kills it each and every week. He is our art director, and he is just one of the most talented people I know. So Travis, if you're listening, thank you for all you do for the show. Also, I want to say, if you want to buy a 605 Super Podcast t-shirt or a Yo Mamba 605 t-shirt, you can do that at tinyurl.com/superpodstore. If you want to support us using Amazon, tinyurl.com/superpodamazon. And of course, if you want to make a donation, if you appreciate all the work, the hard work that goes into the show, consider making a donation, which you can make at paypal.me/superpodcast. Lots of other shows do Patreons. Lots of other shows have different enticements. If you really like this show, you know it's listener supported, please consider making a donation. You know, I don't know, if you did a buck a month, if you did a buck a week, whatever it is, it would help. It would help a lot. A lot of things.
Buck of the week.
Buck of the week. That's actually a funny idea right there. Of course, we are on iTunes. If you can, please leave a positive review on iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, as well as go through there and give thumbs up to the positive reviews and thumbs down to some of the negative motherfuckers. There's a couple people. One guy said he only listens when Cornette or Bolin are on. Other than that, the show sucks. Hey, fuck you. I'll kick your ass any day of the week with my feet and my fists. But anyway, go to iTunes and hook it up there. And of course, you can go to 605pod.com for all of these links, as well as the RSS feed. And if you want to send anything into the show, you can send it to the 605 Super Podcast, P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. That's the 605 Super Podcast, P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. And of course, listen to Austin Idol Live every Tuesday at austinidolpod.com, available on iTunes, Podcast Addict, and just about everywhere else. But with that said, we are done. Any closing words, Tom?
No, Yeah, just get well so you can kick ass like always. Not that this is not kick ass. A lot of content. And I think the top 10 is going to be incredible and on fire next show.
Next week's, I think, going to be one of the bigger top 10s. If you're a fan of Stuttering Tommy Rich and Handsome Boogeyman and T.R. Knack, next week should be pretty off the hook. So, yeah.
Is that for true?
Yep, I think that's for true. So until next week, for the sick Tom Robinson, I'm the sick Brian Last. Tally-ho! Again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605 Classic. I am your host, the great Brian Last, and with me, as always, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you today? Oh, Ed Whalen. Tom Robinson did a pretty good Ed Whalen a couple weeks ago.
He did a very good Ed Whalen. I was actually surprised in a weird way by just how good his Lance Russell was. Because I feel like usually when I hear people do good Lance Russells, they are Southern, and he's not.
Well, that's the one that got me was Buddy Colt. That was just like, so, because who does a Buddy Colt impression? You never hear anyone do that.
Well, and it was even funnier, I felt, because he's done it before, and he just went into a longer extended riff.
Every other one was like a two-word, you know, David Crockett, Paz, Ed Whalen, Viet Cong, Buddy Colt. It was the entire, let me tell you about Kevin Sullivan. It was the entire promo. It was the entire interview. So that was pretty good. But here we are here today. Let's talk about some stuff that's recently come up here on the Super Podcast. And, you know, I thought of you recently when we did all the Sputnik Monroe stuff because, you know, Sputnik's been added to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame ballot for this year, for 2017. I tried to get Wild Bill Curry on the ballot, and Dave told me that he couldn't get on the ballot after he originally said he would, because Sputnik Monroe and Bill Goldberg were going on the ballot this year, and they had more support. And I know that in the past you were, or, you know, even the recent past, I should say, a booster for the idea of Sputnik being in the Hall of Fame, and we've done all these segments about him. Well, you know, where do you stand? Does he automatically have your vote?
Yeah, he does. I mean, I was one of the people that asked to add him to the ballot. I mean, I also asked Dave to add Curry to the ballot, but what can you do?
What can you do?
Yeah. As far as Sputnik, I mean, I actually pulled up the ballot just so I can pull up the exact language, because I feel like this is important to the argument. So let's do a little find and page history.
Of what?
The criteria. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because, I mean, that's the interesting thing with Sputnik. You can't deny his importance historically. But when it comes to longevity, when it comes to overall impact in multiple territories, that's where it gets a little dicey. And I'm not trying to take a side in that argument, but that's where, you know, because if you're basing his Hall of Fame run on what he did in Memphis in 1959 and 1960, it also opens the door for maybe some other arguments that are very similar for the Hall of Fame.
Sure, but here's kind of where I stand. So if you look at the ballot, the criteria for the Hall of Fame is a combination of drawing power, being a great in-ring performer, or excelling in one's field in pro wrestling, as well as historical significance in a positive manner. A candidate should either have something to offer in all three categories or be someone so outstanding in one or two of the categories that they deserve inclusion. Now, in terms of historical significance, it's not what we usually think of in terms of pro wrestling. It's actually important in real life.
It's cultural significance.
Yes. Yeah. And I know there's the argument that I know now my voice is going. that Dave puts out that, well, it was, why am I joking? Wait, which Fuller/Welch was in charge at the time?
In 59, Roy Welch and Nicholas bought the territory in 57, oh, yeah, I believe.
That Roy Welch was behind it too, wasn't just Sputnik. See, I don't think that's a reason against Sputnik, because the only reason they're able to do this is because they have a star, even if he is theoretically a heel, who's actually going into the black neighborhoods, going to the bars, going to the restaurants, hanging out with them, going to the clubs, patronizing their businesses, hanging out with them, calling them his black friends on TV. And it's genuine because he's actually spending a ton of his free time with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I think Lance Russell has even made that, I don't even want to say argument, but that point that obviously Roy Welch as the promoter, you know, as I said before, Nicholas and Roy Welch bought Memphis in 1957 from Lester Wolf. I shouldn't say Lester, from Les Wolf, excuse me.
Many Lesters.
I know, I'm thinking of Lester Welch and it's fucking me up. But so they've been there a little while and this happened. You know, I guess I'm trying to think of it in terms of a rock and roll kind of analogy, because, you know, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, an artist goes in and their manager, you know, probably won't. And I'm not saying that Roy Welch was the manager of Sputnik Monroe, but, you know, even if he said yes, or even if he said, hey, I have an idea, do this, it all came down to Sputnik. No one else was going to be able to pull that off. And again, he was going down onto Beale Street before they integrated the audiences, after they integrated the audiences. He was still getting arrested for being down there afterwards. And it's also about what's front facing, what the audience is picking up. You know, yes. All the, you know, you hear the stories that all the African-American maids in Memphis would introduce all the white kids that they were watching after to Sputnik because they liked him. Sputnik's popularity was with that audience. It wasn't, hey, here's a manufactured guy put out there. It was him. He was the guy at the center of that hurricane.
Right. And like you talked about a few weeks ago with Cornette on In the News, he was the first white man ever represented by a black lawyer in the city of Memphis.
Which is extraordinary. I mean, it's something to really think about, because I can't, you know, that's the only case of that I can cite. I mean, it's happened everywhere. At one point or another in every single state, there was the first case of a Caucasian being represented by an African-American. That's the only one I know. And it's 1960 or 1959, I guess, was the first time he was represented by him. It's an extraordinary story, I guess. To cite something else that was brought up on the Super Podcast, if Sputnik's Hall of Fame eligibility and candidacy is reliant on that story, how do you look at something like, and I didn't know too much about this until I started talking about it on the show, Len Rossi coming up with the idea of having an integrated tag team, and he was the first guy to have an integrated tag team, him and Bearcat Brown, in that same territory, and they were incredibly popular.
I feel like there's a case, but it's not quite the same as the actual integrating of the event and the audience.
Yeah. And I mean, there was no court case or anything. It was just, they did it and it worked. And the white fans took for, you know, they took up for Bearcat Brown against Ken Ramey and the interns. You know, Sputnik was a different case, because the other thing too is Sputnik was a heel. I mean, it's very easy to forget that, because it's a very baby-faced thing to say, I'm going to integrate the crowds. The white fans hated Sputnik, you know, except for like the cool kids in like high school. It was the African-Americans that loved him, because he was so, you know, I hate to say it, but he wasn't as white as the other white guys.
He
was a little funky.
Yeah, and then he milked it for years, because he did the whole thing where Norvell Austin teamed with him, and that was, what, early 70s?
That was like 70, maybe 71, 72.
Right, and like Cornette talked about, the heat was that they kind of tried to imply that Norvell was his son. And I'm trying to remember where I read this. It was one of the many like non-wrestling publication articles about Sputnik that's out there. They would do a shtick where they would, one of them would say like, white is beautiful. The other would say black is beautiful. And then they would join hands and say white and black are beautiful together.
What?
And that was still heat, at least for a while.
You know, no one brings it up, but when we always talk about these discussions of like, oh, I wish there was footage of Blassie Tolis, the angle, and I wish there was this. I wish there was Sputnik footage on TV with a young Lance Russell getting things going. Like, that's the one, like, we'll never see that. We'll hear all these stories about him and Billy Wicks, but we'll never see any of those promos or hear any of those promos. And that's what I really wanted, you know, because you see Sputnik, you know, there's footage of him working matches from the early to mid 70s on. And of course, he's in Memphis in 1980, he's back there as a manager. So he cuts some promos and stuff, but we really don't, we've never gotten the chance to see what he really brought to the table.
No, but you gotta assume that it was good just based on everything that happened. I mean, I'd kind of be curious also where in history he stands as far as guys who did that kind of, I mean, I gotta assume just from like reading quotes and everything we hear that he did do some variation of the, for lack of a better term, jive promo style that we associate with Dusty, Thunderbolt Patterson, etc.
Right. He was connecting with that audience because he was speaking their language. It wasn't just, I'm a white guy with a, you know, a streak of white hair and my black hair or anything else. He was speaking to people. I mean, they related to him.
Right. So I'm curious, is he the first guy, black or white, that did that? If not, who came before him?
Who came before him in the very limited period of time where wrestling was on TV with guys doing promos?
Exactly.
You know, that's definitely an interesting argument. I had never thought of it in that context. He may have been the very first.
And I think that's something too, because for better or for worse, in markets that had big black populations, that type of character tended to draw.
This idea that someone could get into the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame for cultural relevance, on a historical level. Where do you think the line is drawn and how big does it get? Do you think Jesse Ventura is a Hall of Famer because he's a wrestler who crossed over into being a politician and a television star and everything else? Do you think, you know, I'm someone who's always said I think Sergeant Slaughter is a Hall of Famer. And a lot of that, in my eyes, is because he was big with kids my age on G.I. Joe. Before I knew him as a wrestler, I knew him as the wrestler on G.I. Joe. That was big. His action figure, the mail-away one, was a big deal when I was a kid. So where do you think, you know, I guess it's a mix between actual fame and cultural importance. Where do you think that line is drawn?
I think Sputnik's an outlier because in his case, the wrestling is directly feeding into the cultural significance. It's not just fame. It's that he, as a pro wrestler doing his pro wrestling gimmick, you know, fed into everything. Whereas Jesse is a retired pro wrestler running for governor. You know what I mean? I feel like it's not the same thing. I get what you're saying, but do you know what I mean? I don't think there's necessarily a slippery slope or anything like that there.
Right. I'm not trying to compare what Sputnik did and was involved in, but I'm just trying to say, you know, I always try to figure out, you know, this overall story of the Hall of Fame, what makes someone a Hall of Famer, what restricts someone from being a Hall of Fame. You know, Sayama, the original Tiger Mask, is in based on 2 years. The Midnight Express, my favorite tag team, is in based on 6 years and two different versions of the team. You know, so I always try to look at it. Kurt Angle, you know, something more modern. He went into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, what, 5 years into his career? 6 years into his career?
Year was it? Let me look. Give me 1 second. Yeah. Talk while I look.
I mean, he went in relatively quick. It was probably 2005 or 2006. And he started in, what, 99? So that's just a few years into his career. And I think about that because, again, my argument for Junkyard Dog, my argument for potentially for Kerry Von Erich and for Sergeant Slaughter was what they did in a similar amount of time. JYD for 5 years was one of the biggest stars in the wrestling business. He popped the Mid-South territory. He was the number two babyface to Hulk Hogan when he first came up for the first year. He was a major crossover star in terms of, I can tell you from me when I was a kid, the Junkyard Dog LJN was a big deal. Him on Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling was a big deal. And of course, Kerry Von Erich, you know, that's another one where you get a little interesting. How big was he and the Von Erichs culturally in Texas before everything went crazy? Are you
yes.
back? You got the answer?
Yes, yes. Well, yes, I was waiting for you to finish talking. Kurt Angle, 2004.
Wow. So, I mean, that's 5 years into his career.
Yep, pretty much.
See, I mean,
and
That's fascinating.
I mean, not to go off on the whole tangent, but do you think that it looks worse in hindsight, considering just kind of the way his career fell off the rails just a couple years later?
I mean, that's what made me think about him recently was I was reading a story, maybe even in The Observer, about him going into the WWE Hall of Fame. And when you stop and you realize he was in TNA longer than he was in the WWE, and they're never going to acknowledge that. You know? And he was in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame before he even went to TNA. Now, look, he was an elite worker from almost the day he came up in terms of the modern comedy type promos and backstage skits. He actually was one of those guys that excelled in those. So he was as good as it got for a long time. But, you know, after he got into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, he had all of his issues with substance abuse. Vince wouldn't touch him for many years because he was afraid he would die on his watch. And he didn't want those headlines of Olympic gold medalist dies working for the WWE. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to say he's not a Hall of Famer because he's already in there. But if he hadn't gotten in then and he was up for the vote now, would he get in? If Kurt Angle wasn't in and people had to vote on him now, would he get in, Bix?
I think he'd get in, but it wouldn't be overwhelming the way it was at the time.
Yeah, so the Hall of Fame's an interesting thing. What'd you think about the Rock and Roll Express going into the WWE Hall of Fame?
Pleasantly surprised.
Right? Who's going to induct him?
I feel like the Vince Logic choice would be someone like a Michael Hayes, even though it doesn't really make sense.
That's what I was thinking, too, because I figured Michael Hayes was one of the guys actually boosting for them behind the scenes.
I, if JR is there, he would certainly fit.
Oh, what a lovely speech that'll be. Oh, God. I want to tell you that Robert Gibson was a good hand. He was a good hand. Ugh. Well, never. People know what I think of JR nowadays. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, we've talked about it. It kind of opens the door potentially for the Midnight Express. That'll be an interesting one. Jimmy's the first guy who, it's not really a Vince McMahon issue, it's a Kevin Dunn issue, you know, which I don't think there's been any other case of that. Everyone else who they've reconciled with, from the Warrior to Bruno, it was always an issue with Vince, not an issue with the producer. So it's an interesting dynamic. But on the topic of Hall of Famers, you know, this Jimmy Snuka stuff went down. We did the show a couple weeks ago, me and John McAdam talking about him. I know you were very vocal on Twitter after he passed away, especially after WWE did their tribute. And this is something you've always spoken about. I mean, we talked about it on the show really early on. So what are your thoughts now? Now that he's actually passed away, now that the case was dismissed because of mental incompetence, you know, 2 weeks before he passed away, where are you at now? What are you thinking about all this?
Relative to before he passed away or relative to right after he passed away? Or
relative to his place historically in wrestling history.
I mean, I think history is going to look back on him kinder than it could have because of the timing of his health issues. And so, I mean, that's obvious. As far as kind of further than, I mean, I'm really not sure. I feel like in a weird way, the truth of the, I mean, you know, we can't say for sure what happened, but we look at the evidence. It seems likely that he killed her, that he killed Nancy Argentina. We should make sure we say her name.
Yeah, that's true.
But it, in a weird way, I feel kind of like the facts maybe won't get lost with time, kind of the way you might think, because when everyone was just kind of being dumb, and in the case of some media people, just not doing research in the immediate aftermath of his death. I mean, that's the crowding of everything that happens right away. I mean, in the long run, the way that culture is now and the way people get information, if you look up Jimmy Snuka murder or whatever, you're probably going to get a decent version a decently accurate version of what happened in the long. You know what I mean? So I think in terms of that, I think the timing kind of almost works against him because it's going to be in the various stories about his death, et cetera. It'll kind of feed into it more in the long run than maybe it would have in the immediate aftermath of him dying when everyone's still kind of trying to memorialize him. But as far as his career, I don't know, because I think it depends on like just kind of how he's covered further historically, because yeah, the comparison that I've been making some, including in the article I wrote about this for Vocative Sports, is OJ, because he did technically lose the wrongful death lawsuit, even if it was by default.
Right.
And when you see discussions of OJ online, it's always thrown in there. I mean, you know what I mean? You don't have people these days that'll say, well, oh, he was acquitted. It's usually, if there is someone like that, they're getting shouted down by everyone else who's like, no, you're being stupid. And then there's all this other stuff. As far as his actual career, I'm honestly not sure whether his career will become either overrated or underrated historically, because I can see it going both ways. Did you kind of know what I mean?
I do. You know, I've run into something. It was brought up to me. One of the listeners, Josh Greenbaum, a very frequent contributor to the facebook.com/superpodcast, brought up a point, and he's not wrong, but he was trying to point out that there's a bit of a difference in the way people are treating Jimmy Snuka in his passing than how they treated Chris Benoit. And I can't watch a Chris Benoit match. I can't. I can't watch him in the ring and enjoy it. For some reason, I could still watch Snuka. And it doesn't make me happy to say that. And I've openly said on this show that I think he killed Nancy Argentino. But there is a difference. And I don't know what exactly it is. I mean, maybe it's because there was the kid involved with the Benoit case. Maybe because it was really 3 days of carnage, as opposed to a guy in a steroid and cocaine-induced state beating up his girlfriend again. And he took it. You know, that's the thing. Benoit intended to murder at least Daniel. At least. Maybe Nancy, too. I don't believe Jimmy Snuka intended to kill Nancy Argentino. I think Jimmy Snuka, as he had done before and as he did after, was unfortunately battering a woman. And it went too far. And the injuries were too severe. And he couldn't turn back. What do you think, Bix?
I actually lost track of my original thought.
It's just like the old days.
No, it's like I had it. I had the thread, and then it's you went for a minute longer than I expected it to. And
I was just the whole
intense
idea.
I was intensely listening.
Just the whole idea that, you know, I can't watch Benoit, but I can.
Oh, okay. Stop. Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
If you feel free to edit this if you want. It's two things. That if you're following wrestling at the time, it just comes out of nowhere, and it's so chilling. You know what I mean with Benoit? It's just a completely different reaction. It feels more visceral regardless, just because it's so tied into your reaction at the time and him being this hardcore fan favorite and the contrast and blah, 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 blah. And then if you're someone who's read more about the case, there's also that he killed his son with his finishing hold.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you agree with me? My theory that Snuka didn't intend to kill her. That it was just, that's the way it turned out.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm also of the opinion that doesn't really matter, which I'm presuming you are too.
No, he did it. He did it. And I'm not saying that, but you know, there is a difference between premeditated murder and manslaughter.
Yes, there is legally a difference, although it's depending on the place. If it's assault and then you kill someone in the course of the assault, it's still murder.
Sure. But yeah, it's tough to really, you know, and the other interesting thing is, like you said, it was chilling. When Benoit killed his wife and his kid and himself, it was a media thing. It was all over the place. You couldn't escape it. It was one of those real low points for the history of wrestling. And it was everywhere. And it brought out the worst in just about everyone who was on those news shows. Like, you know, from the host of the shows to the guests. And with Snuka, he did this in 1983, and then he still had a long career. And I don't know about you, but I think, when did you first hear that Snuka killed Nancy Argentino? I must have heard about it by like 92, 93, like whispers about it. And it never made me think like, oh, Jimmy Snuka's a bad guy or anything. It's weird. It's weird the way it was kind of a story that was around and accepted until it really got thrown in everyone's face that this had actually happened. When did you first hear about snooker?
I think I saw the Jeff Savage article at some point in the 90s, probably around the same time you did. But I don't know if I even remembered it by the time that I read Irv Musnick's article when he put it online in the late 90s.
Irv's really the one who gets responsibility for making sure everyone paid attention to this story. I mean, like, he did an amazing job as not just a journalist, but an advocate for the Argentino family, making sure that this wasn't forgotten and making sure that this was indeed the legacy that would follow Jimmy Snuka.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but let's not end on a sour note. It's just the conversation's gotten darker and darker since we started talking. But, you know, another popular thing on this show recently has been Dr. Jerry Graham. And I have a bunch of really cool original audio we're going to be playing of him in the weeks to come. But I know you uncovered some Dr. Jerry Graham stuff recently, didn't you, Bix?
Yeah, so I may have an article coming out with this stuff somewhere soon, broken record, but I had done a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI on Tutsmont. It was when I first started looking into this stuff and I got in the habit of, oh, who's dead? Who might be on the FBI's radar? That whole thing.
Tutsmont, of course, being a longtime promoter in the New York area, and he was Vince McMahon's partner, Vince McMahon Sr., when he really, you know, did everything when he started running full time exclusively at Madison Square Garden. And when he broke away from the NWA with Buddy Rogers, Tutsmont was there.
Yes. So back in the late 50s, after the NWA and its members had agreed with the Justice Department that they weren't going to do any blackballing or give people their own defined territories, all those silly things that wrestling promoters stopped doing in 1954. After that, it turns out that Jim Crockett was shutting out the Elephant Boy, the wrestler, the Elephant Boy, who got Fabulous Moolah kind of started in pro wrestling from promoting in Virginia. It was Crockett Sr. and his partner in Virginia. It was Bill Lewis, and Elephant Boy, William Olivas, wanted to promote there, and he asked if he could, you know, promote towns for them. They said no. And then he started to promote on his own, got TV stations lined up, got wrestlers lined up. And of course, what do you think happens?
You know, obviously Crockett Sr. tried to shut him out and screw him, and Elephant Boy said, I'm gonna go to the Justice Department. Hello, this is Elephant Boy on the line. Can I speak to the Attorney General?
Yes. His brother, Kid Vicious, was at the meeting with him, too.
Not Fred the Elephant Boy. For everyone listening, please, it's not Fred the Elephant Boy. It's the elephant. I guess when Moolah was with him, she was Slave Girl Moolah, right?
Yes. Yes.
Slave Girl Moolah and Elephant Boy. And then later on, Moolah had her own crew of slaves. But anyway, back to your story, Bix.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Yeah, I thought we weren't going to that place anymore.
Oh, is that one of those things that we're supposed to forget about?
Well, after the last 10 minutes, yes. So he was friends with Dr. Jerry Graham. And Dr. Jerry Graham had told him he could help. And, well, why don't I just read from what I got from the files of the FBI?
Okay.
A wrestler known as Dr. Jerry Graham, whom both all of us and his attorney redacted. Yes, for some reason, the lawyer's name is redacted. say could substantiate much that all of us has charged, was interviewed by special agents Broden and redacted. Only one of the FBI agents' names is redacted on December 3rd, 1959, without success. And Graham was also called to testify before the commission. In his testimony, he denied knowledge of any of the facts charged by all of us. However, it appears that the denial was the result of threats made to Graham by Vince McMahon Sr. So then we have this in parenthesis. The waiting room adjoining the room in which the hearings in front of, I think this was the Virginia Athletic Commission, were held in, was secretly bugged by redacted, and the tape recording contained snatches of conversation between Crockett and McMahon, in the course of which McMahon told Crockett, I told that it looks like this is under redaction. Looks like this is some kind of expletive. I told that blank Jerry a few times, listen, I don't care about your feelings. Don't do anything to hurt Bill Lewis, because if you do, you're hanging yourself. You know where your bread is buttered. Self-preservation, he said. And then another blank, so I'm assuming Dr. Jerry Graham is being quoted by Vince Sr. here as saying, fuck it.
Sounds like him.
Graham then left for a European wrestling tour. However, on a recent telecast in Washington, D.C., Dr. Graham, that's how they refer to him here, was announced as one of the participating wrestlers. The agent should inform all of us and redacted, I presume the lawyer, of Graham's return to this country and see if they can supply any facts which would make it worthwhile for the Bureau to again interview Graham. How about that?
I would have loved to have heard the tapes of the Bureau interviewing Graham. You suck your mother's pussy. You eat J. Edgar Hoover's asshole. Well, I mean, what's your takeaway from all that, Bix?
My takeaway is that they may in their archives have secret recordings of Vince McMahon and Jim Crockett, Vince McMahon Sr. and Joe Crockett Sr. talking shop in some random municipal building in Virginia in 1960.
It's too bad it's not in McMahon's New York office, or, you know, where he used to go. Bob Barnett's dad had the office of the New York State Athletic Commissioner, and Vince McMahon was in there every week.
Well, you know what, though? It is the FBI. I mean, I was going to say maybe they had it bucked too, but I wouldn't put it past them. I would think maybe if there was anything, it might be here, but who knows? But I thought that was fascinating. And now, because I had actually filed a request for stuff about Vince Sr., and they said that everything they had been destroyed. So I filed an appeal pointing this out because for those who aren't aware, the FBI's relationship with the Freedom of Information Act is complicated. And by complicated, I mean they do everything in their power not to comply with it. So I was granted the appeal, though. So theoretically, now they're looking harder. And who knows? We may get more.
And before we go, why typically, if they give a reason, would the reason be for them destroying any files?
There is a rule that allows them to do it after a certain amount of time with things that are declassified and all that. But stuff is either destroyed or then sent to the National Archives. Obviously, you'd prefer for it to be sent to the National Archives. There was one thing, I think it may have even been the Vince Sr. stuff, where I want to say, like, when I got the initial letter back from them of the stuff that they had listed as being about Vince Sr., that I maybe filed in July, and what I got back from them was saying that what they had tied to him was destroyed in January, the previous January.
Huh, interesting.
So, great timing by me, as usual.
Yeah, well, speaking of timing, that is it for this week. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at GreatBrianLash. You can follow Bix on Twitter at DavidBix. But until next time, tally-ho!